Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hey, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. We're going through the book of Exodus, and I want to ask you, do you ever feel like you're in the wilderness of life? Well, as the Israelites were wandering, they got test after test from God. It was like a graduate education in the inner life, like going to Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard. This time, it's a different test. The question is, this time, are they going to pass the test? Will you and I pass the test? Let's look at Exodus chapter 16, if you want to open up your Bibles. It says, they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they had departed from the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the sons of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness and said to them, would that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, at evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your murmurings against the Lord. For what are we that you murmur against us? And Moses said, when the Lord gives you in the evening flesh to eat and in the morning bread to the full, because the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmur against him, what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord. And Moses said to Aaron, say to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings. And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord said to Moses, I have heard the murmurings of the sons of Israel. Say to them, at twilight you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God. In the evening quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning dew lay round about the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as hoarfrost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, every man of you, as much as he can eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of the persons whom each of you has in his tent. And the sons of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. Each gathered according to what he could eat. And Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it till the morning. But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. On the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers apiece. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay by to be kept until the morning. So they laid it by till the morning, as Moses bade them, and it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day some of the people went out to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain every man of you in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And Moses said, This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness, when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And Moses said to Aaron, Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it, and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the covenant to be kept. And the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years, till they came to a habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is the tenth part of an ephah. And that's the scripture reading for today. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark, and I know you've been racking your brain for years wondering how to measure an omer. Well, now you know. Now you know. An omer is the tenth part of an ephah. I'm sure that clears everything up for you, right? So let's take a look at really what this means. Again, it's test after test for the Israelites. One writer said that going into the wilderness was really the Oxford, the Cambridge, you could say the Harvard or the Stanford for God's people. That was their graduate education in the inner life before they were going to enter the promised land. In the wilderness of sin, this is so intriguing that it mentions this at the beginning of chapter 16. It says, They set out from Elam. The congregations of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Now, it's actually a bit of a translation issue. It's really the wilderness of Sinai, but in some English translations, it says the wilderness of Sin. But I think that's quite appropriate because there was a lot of sinning that was going to happen there. They haven't quite gotten themselves straightened out yet. But it's really the Sinai region. They're not at Mount Sinai yet. Mount Sinai, by the way, is the same as Mount Horeb. It means the same mountain. And this is the mountain, of course, where Moses received the Ten Commandments, the tablets, and also where he got this vision of the tabernacle, how it was to be constructed based on this heavenly blueprint. And so they're in this region, and it's intriguing. It's intriguing that what are the things that, okay, so they just had this big temptation about water. They were thirsty. There were 3 days without anything to drink. There were the bitter waters of Marah. God made them sweet. We talked about that in the last episode. So now the issue isn't thirst, it's hunger. And what do they start saying? The Israelites say, I wish we died in Egypt. Oh, back in the good old days when we sat by the flesh pots. That's another interesting translation. Now, what are the flesh pots? It's actually pots of meat, the flesh they used to eat in Egypt. And we had bread to the full. So their memories are obviously pretty selective about their experience. Don't you remember the slavery part? Don't you remember the beatings? Don't you remember the incredibly backbreaking labor? They tend to kind of be pretty selective in what they remember, and they almost want to go back. They wish they weren't on this journey towards freedom. And it's sad that many people do prefer spiritual slavery to the freedom of the children of God that St. Paul talks about in the New Testament. And this can happen to us sometimes as Catholics. If we have, maybe you're a convert to the Catholic faith. Maybe you're a revert. Maybe you were somebody who really didn't take their faith seriously. Maybe you were a sino, Catholic in name only, and now you've come to this deeper relationship with the Lord. Maybe Relevant Radio has helped you to grow closer to the Lord. If so, we're thankful for that. But sometimes what happens is you have a hankering, a longing for your old way of life. Man, we had fun back in the good old days, didn't we? Well, maybe it wasn't as much fun as you thought. Because one of the things that St. Paul says is that the wages of sin is death. It brings about spiritual death. And it is at some level, on a human level, on a natural level, on a carnal level, fun. Otherwise, people wouldn't do these things. And But really what they are is disordered goods, and that's a great definition of sin, that the devil can't create anything. All he does is try to tempt us to use the good things of God in the wrong way, at the wrong time, in the wrong place, with the wrong person. And that's true when it comes to sexual sins outside of marriage. It's true when it comes to abuse of the creation. Wine is a great gift from God, but people misuse it and become drunk. Those are a couple of little examples there, but maybe not so little to some people. They've been great sins, great traps for many. But we have this tendency to almost glamorize a way of life apart from God. Maybe sometimes even wishing we could do things that sinners are doing all the time. Well, don't fall for that trap. Don't fall for that trap. The good life is really with God. So what are they longing for? The meats they used to eat in Egypt, the flesh pots, Egyptian barbecue. They want to go back. And so this is going to be the proving ground for another test in the wilderness that God is going to give the Israelites, just like the bitter waters of Marah were a test, and they failed that test. This is going to be a test surrounding food, but it's also going to be a test regarding obedience, because God is going to promise, and he's going to give this gift of the manna. Now, the Israelites, when they first saw it, they said, "What is it?" And then that's actually what manna means. It means in Hebrew, "What is it?" It's a question. That's not what the Lord called it, of course. He called it the bread from heaven. But the test was going to be obedience, because they were only to gather enough for the day. And on the sixth day, they had to gather for 2 days. Now, on any other day, if they tried to hoard the manna, if they tried to gather a stockpile enough for the next week, it would go rotten in the morning, and worms would be in it. It would just stink, and it was a mess. But on the sixth day, they could gather enough for 2 days, and it wouldn't spoil. Why? Because they had to keep the Sabbath rest on the seventh day. So they couldn't be, as one writer says, resisting a rest, as it were. They had to rest with God, enjoy their friends, their family, most of all, their time with God. This is the way that God has created us. We can't be working 24/7. Work is good. It's a gift from God. But he has ordained these times, these appointed times for us to rest and to worship. And so it's a test of faith for them. It's also a test of faith for us. We have to understand that we can't stockpile the grace of God either. In the Our Father, what is the line in the prayer? Give us this day our daily bread, not our weekly bread, not our monthly bread, not our yearly bread. This is what I like to call the manna mentality, the manna mentality. So we have to trust God not only for our daily physical needs to be met, physical food, but also our spiritual needs as well. And it's kind of interesting that when the church fathers interpreted the Lord's Prayer that Jesus gave, some spiritual writers throughout the history of the church, they said really what Jesus is talking about isn't just our physical bread, give us this day our daily bread, but also what they called our super substantial bread, our supernatural bread. And of course, that is a reference to the Eucharist. I'm going to talk about the Eucharist in a little bit. But we do know that God also provides daily for our other supernatural needs that we need. We need peace that passes all understanding in these times of anxiety. And here's the thing. We spend a lot of our time worrying about the past. We spend a lot of our mental energies living in the past, which is gone, or future events, which aren't here yet. And you can't stockpile grace for the future. And in the past, we leave it to God's mercy. It's in the rearview mirror. We can learn the lessons, hopefully. And the Israelites needed to learn some lessons. How quickly they forget after miracle, now they're testing God all over again. But future events, they're not here yet. We can't stockpile grace for the future. There's no sense worrying about it. Are you going to have enough grace for the future? Well, when we worry about future events, and believe me, yours truly is as guilty as anyone. I'm a big worry ward. But really what it is, it's an attempt to try to control God, control the situation, to not let go, to not abandon yourself to divine providence, understanding that God will give you the grace when you need it, for the moment. You can't stockpile it just like the manna, otherwise it'll go rotten. And so in our own personal lives, in our daily lives. That's why it's really important to try to be consistent in our prayer life. Whether it's we made this commitment to go to daily mass, to pray the rosary daily. Some of you have made that commitment with the Family Rosary Across America with Father Rocky each night on Relevant Radio. Our daily prayer, our mental prayer. We can't say, well, you know what? I'm going to pray for 3 hours today because I probably won't have enough time the rest of the week. I'll kind of stockpile my prayer, if you will. No, you can't do that. As one preacher said, imagine trying to do this in your personal relationships with your wife. Hey, honey, let's just have a really long talk tonight for a couple hours. You can just kind of pour out your heart to me because I got a really busy week lined up. There are a lot of football games I want to watch on the weekend. I probably won't have time to talk to you later. So we'll connect again. Yeah, that's not going to go over well. In the same way, we can't do that with God either. We have to really be consistent with our prayer, with these means of grace that he's given us. It's a little bit like telephone poles. Now, a lot of telephone lines obviously are buried underground these days, but we all remember telephone poles and how the wires, if the telephone poles are too close together, maybe the lines will sag a little bit. And if they're too far apart, same thing might happen. They've got to be the right distance apart. They've got to be spread apart so that those wires don't sag too much. They don't hit the ground. And so we've got to spread out our prayer times, examine our day, break it down. When are we going to go to Mass? When are we going to do our morning prayer? When are we going to do our evening prayer? When are we going to read the gospel? When are we going to do our spiritual writing, or spiritual reading rather? And so we've got to kind of level that out so that the power source is consistent throughout the day, just like telephone poles as they go along the road of life. So it's a great way to look at it. You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, Cale Clark. But back to the text here. Really what was going on here when the Israelites were hoarding and they all kind of went rotten, it was an attempt to try to control the situation, to control God, to not abandon themselves to divine providence, that God was going to provide what they needed on the day of. I remember when I was in business school, we used to learn about, in terms of manufacturing, something called just-in-time, or JIT, delivery and processing, where it's like books being printed on demand when you ordered them from Amazon. Well, it's a little bit like that with God's grace. It's just in time, just in the nick of time. God knows when we need him. We've all had these experiences when our faith has been stretched, but then God comes through. The money somehow appears to pay the bills. Or, you know, we get that answer, that phone call that we need. There's so many things that we could say about this. And that's kind of what it's like for us. Now, also, by the way, in terms of how God fed the Israelites, he really did go above and beyond in catering to their desires. He didn't have to give them the quail. I mean, he gave them the manna. And I'm sure that got a little bit dry, no pun intended, day after day after day. In fact, the text says for 40 years they ate the manna. And I'm sure it got a little quote-unquote boring time after time after time. Maybe they were sharing different creative recipes. As one preacher said, maybe they made manicotti, banana bread, and hey, have you tried it with Dijon mustard? There was a temptation to get bored. And I think as Catholics, sometimes we almost get that way with the faith. We say the Mass is boring. It's the same thing over and over and over again. I want something new. I want something exciting. And I've seen people leave the church to go to other congregations, other preachers who are a little bit more exciting, a little bit more inventive, perhaps, intriguing, a new message maybe. But this is a danger. This is a great temptation to understand that there's always something deeper that we can learn, whether it's a lot of the lessons that we receive are the same again and again, but again, they're new every morning too, because there's always a better way we can put them into practice. We can always go deeper in our faith. And it's also amazing, and this kind of foreshadows the Ark of the Covenant, which God will command to be created. God says, take a jar, take an omer, and keep that manna. Keep it as a memorial so that the Israelites can see this. This is how your forefathers were fed in the desert. And that jar of the manna was one of the things that was in the Ark of the Covenant. And this foreshadows, of course, the much greater bread that God will give, the flesh of Jesus Christ, given to us sacramentally. in the Eucharist. And so this quail, God gives them the quail as well. This is kind of a treat. He didn't give them the quail all the time. The manna, yeah, they got it all the time. The quail was kind of a special treat. Now, they were missing the flesh pots of Egypt. Well, I'm going to give you the quail. He didn't have to do that. Didn't have to do that, but God did. It's interesting. Flesh and bread. The flesh of the quail, the bread, if you will, of the manna. Can you think of a heavenly meal that involves flesh and bread? In fact, flesh given under the appearance of bread. Of course, it's the Eucharist. We'll get to that later. Now, it's some scholars want to say, by the way, that the manna kind of resulted from natural processes alone. There were trees that had kind of a sap that would get on the ground, and maybe that's what it was. It got dried up. It was sweet. Now, listen, I'm not denying that God can use natural means to bring about the supernatural. That's what the sacraments are, really. The Baltimore Catechism defines a sacrament as an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. So the outward signs are the matter. You say, what's the matter? It's the physical matter from the physical world. It becomes kind of the vehicle for the supernatural life, the grace that's being transmitted. The water is the vehicle for God's grace, washing away sin. Water obviously is cleansing. It gives life. And that's exactly what's happening in baptism. Sins are washed away. Supernatural life is given. The oil, the anointing of the sick, the oil of confirmation, unleavened bread and wine mixed with a drop of water, of course, becomes the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ in the Eucharist. And so, yeah, natural elements could be involved, but this is still a supernatural event. I don't believe the biblical minimalists, the naturalists, who say that there's no supernatural thing to be seen here. No, no, no. These are many, many thousands in the wilderness, and you can't feed this many people with the merely natural. That should be pretty obvious in the text. Now, when we hear about the manna that was given to the Israelites in Exodus, we naturally, maybe supernaturally, think of how Jesus is the true bread of life, greater than the manna. And we'll deal with that in the next episode of The Faith Explained as we look at the book of Exodus. But now, let's open up the Q&A mailbag. Okay, let's open up our Q&A mailbag. And once again, a reminder, you can email me your question. The address is faith, F-A-I-T-H, at relevantradio.com, or you can get it to me on Twitter. Follow me there at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And this question comes to me from Courtney in Mobile, Alabama, who asks, hi, Cale, did St. Paul write the letter to the Hebrews? It used to be called, at least at Mass when it came up in the readings, the letter of St. Paul to the Hebrews. Now it's just called the letter to the Hebrews. Why is that? That's a very good question. Who wrote Hebrews? Well, the short answer is only God knows, but that's probably not super satisfying to you, Courtney. So I would say that Paul probably didn't write it, and it used to be thought that he did, and the reason why it's listed in your Bible and your New Testament is simply the letter to the Hebrews. It's not listed, tagged any particular authors, and we don't know who wrote it. Now, the scholar Thomas Schreiner wrote a piece about this recently, and he talked about sort of the history of who they thought wrote it. Clement of Alexandria. And he was operational around AD 150 to 215 AD. He actually thought that the letter was written by Paul originally in Hebrew and then translated into Greek by Luke. And we know, of course, that Luke was the traveling companion of St. Paul. Luke wrote about a quarter of the New Testament. Paul wrote quite a big chunk, too, obviously, with his letters. But Luke wrote, of course, his Gospel and the Acts of the Apostles, which is kind of the early history of the church. And Luke, by the way, his Greek is phenomenal. It's approaching classical Greek. We know all the New Testament documents that we have are in Greek. There might have been some Hebrew originals to a couple of them that were translated into Greek, and some people think that was the case with Hebrews. Well, Origen, who was another early church scholar, and he was, again, probably AD 185 to about 253 or so AD. That's when he was around. He actually said, well, the thoughts in the letter are from Paul, but somebody else actually wrote it down. And a lot of people have thought this, even to the present day, that whoever wrote Hebrews was a student of St. Paul, maybe, who sort of has assimilated his thought, but it's not exactly St. Paul. And the reason why, when you compare Hebrews to a lot of the other letters that we know Paul wrote, there's some different stuff in there. It doesn't quite fit with the way he liked to say things, the phraseology, that sort of thing. So Origen also said this. He passed on a tradition that either Luke or Clement of Rome, one of the early popes, was the author. But he didn't really say, I'm not going to throw my lot in and say, I think this guy wrote it. He was pretty agnostic about it. He actually said this. Who wrote the letter to the Hebrews? Only God knows. Only God knows. So let's look at the situation in the Western wing of the church. Tertullian, another really key figure who wrote AD 155 to AD 220. He said that Barnabas was the author. And Barnabas, of course, was one of the early missionary companions of St. Paul. Now, that's intriguing because we know from the Acts of the Apostles, look at Acts 4:36, Barnabas was actually a Levite. He was a Levite. And when you look at the letter to the Hebrews, there's so much in there about how Jesus is our great high priest, the Levitical priesthood, and how Christ has transformed that. And so maybe it's intriguing, but people didn't really go for that in church history. And then St. Jerome, great biblical interpreter and scholar, St. Augustine, they sort of said, oh, no, I think Paul actually wrote this. And so that kind of became the dominant thought, that Paul wrote it. And then after the Protestant Revolution in the 16th century, that's when some different theories started to come up once again. Martin Luther said, hey, there's no way that Paul wrote this. Luther thought that Hebrews was written by Apollos. Now, Apollos was a preacher in the early church. You can read about him all over the place, Acts of the Apostles. Paul mentions him in 1 Corinthians. He came to the Corinthian church. Apollos was a brilliant rhetorician. He was a great preacher, very, very eloquent, very, very learned. That's a good guess. I mean, he might have had this classical-type Greek training as well, like Luke did. He might have been the guy who wrote it. Thomas Schreiner says that Hebrews has an Alexandrian feel. Of course, Apollos was from Alexandria in Egypt. That was kind of his roots there. So maybe that kind of philosophy got into the letter. But there have been so many guesses as to who wrote it. Some even say Priscilla wrote it. Priscilla and Aquila, of course, Aquila's wife. Silas, Epaphras, Jude, Aristion, another early church figure. David Allen thinks Luke wrote it himself. At the end of the day, we simply do not know. And I think what we said off the top is probably maybe the best guess of all. Only God knows. But we do know this. It is the Word of God, and it has a lot to say to us today. Thank you so much for your question. And you can write in yours. If you have a question, I'll try to answer it on air on The Faith Explained. Just write to me at faith@relevantradio.com. I'm Cale Clark. We'll catch you in the next one. God bless you. Peace.